Hello, and welcome to episode 18 of the Criterion Reflections podcast. I'm David Blakesley, and tonight we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the crate, as they say, getting into Masahiro Shinoda's The Scandalous Adventures of Burai Khan. Now, if you've never heard of The Scandalous Adventures of Burai Khan, it's maybe because you just haven't been cruising through the film-struck catalog of films released in the spring of 1970. But I have, and fortunately, I'm not in this all by myself. I got a couple friends returning who've been on previous episodes, and I'm really glad that I was able to enjoy their insights on this semi-obscure Japanese flick from 1970. A little period piece with a little bit of contemporary sensibility as the Japanese cinema scene figured out where it was going in the spring of that year. So listen on and enjoy the conversation to talk about Masahiro Shinoda's Burai Khan. Okay, hello. I am here with Arik Devens. Hello, Arik. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Very good to have you. And Robert Taylor. Hello, Robert.
Hi.
All right. Well, both of you guys are making your second visit on season two of Criterion Reflections, and it's really nice to have you back. I kind of love the mix and match of this little community that we're building here. And before we get into our discussion about Masahiro Shinoda's The Scandalous Adventures of Burai Khan. Let's just go ahead and do a little bit of what you've been up to lately. So, Robert, I know you just posted on Facebook a little encounter you had with one of our other cast members here, Jordan Esso. So tell us a little bit about that meetup, and we'll see what you have to say about that.
Well, Jordan and I recorded together for you for Downhill Racer, the movie that scarred me for the rest of my life. And we began a, you know, friendship over that, and he was in town. He normally lives down here, but he has been up in San Francisco for a bit, and he came back. I was super excited, and so we had Brazilian food together and just enjoyed life. We talked a lot about you, David, and don't worry, at least 10% of it was positive.
Okay. No, at least a representative sampling, I hope, yes. Yeah, Jordan was also out in the Okefenokee Swamp or something like that. So, I don't know, do you have any tales of the Georgia wilderness or something like that? I
mean, what was never speak of that. He was burying bodies. Don't worry about it.
Okay. We'll see if this makes the final cut there. So, well, it's great to have you back, right? All right. Any other interesting news and tidbits before I get Arik's fill in there?
Well, the new season of my show, Spirit Riding Free, premiered on Friday. I'm not sure when this is going up, but it is available, and I wrote episode 2.
And that is available on Netflix? Is that who's carrying it? Or is it multiple streaming services? Where do you find that?
Yes, it is up on Netflix, which is the perfect segue into Arik.
Arik, yes, you've recently started employment at Netflix. You got married.
Yeah.
You're just kind of in life transition mode, aren't you?
Yeah, there's been a lot going on. Yeah, I'm actually still sort of in the middle of the wedding things. My extended family is all still in town. It's nice to get they're lovely, wonderful people, but it's nice to get a little break to do something, a little more, not wedding related, but it was wonderful. I did just start working a couple months ago for Netflix, which is, also wonderful. So, everything in my life is pretty good, except that with all this stuff, I haven't had a lot of time to work on my History of Jazz podcast, which is still happening. It's just, a lot going on, so
yeah, life is happening. So, but yeah, I'm breathlessly awaiting 1920 and beyond. So
I know, me
hope
too.
You get to it fairly soon. But you know, we were talking just before we hit the record button about the updates to the Criterion website, and as a web design expert of sorts, I was kind of getting your feedback. And I said, "Hey, let's go ahead and save this for the podcast." So. you know, the Criterion.com website went down for a couple days, came back, kind of a big splash, kind of new design. Some of the features are still works in progress, but I don't know. Do you have a critique for us? Any kind of insight as to what you think is happening with the new site or where you see it might be going?
I don't know if I know where it might be going. I would say that it was sort of long overdue in some ways. I mean, I love the old site. I actually remember when the previous redesign came out and how revelatory that one was at the time. It was absolutely at the top of my list for like really, really awesome site design. But it was starting to look a little long in the tooth. The web has kind of moved on. We have bigger screens now. We have more bold type ideas. We have kind of things go, you know, sort of edge to edge a lot more, if you will. And the site was starting to look a little sort of constrained, a little sort of just kind of old school in the middle, if you will. I don't know if you understand what I think you probably understand what I'm getting at.
In general terms, yeah, it, you know, kind of static. I mean, now you got a little bit more dynamic. Like you say, it's apparently better for mobile devices. And
it is a lot better. A lot better on mobile. The old site was not responsive, so when you were looking at it on a phone, you were looking at the same sort of zoomed out view of the full website, and now they've actually kind of thought about mobile as a platform. I think that the there are some things I don't like that I hope they change. I mean, it's brand new, so we'll see. But like the homepage that you land on, like I love the bold imagery and stuff, but the fact that the scrolling is animated so that it only goes sort of very deliberately section to section, and there's no way to quickly get from one place to the other is super annoying, and I strongly hope that they get rid of that. There's a little weird thing where there's like a little green check mark on the shopping cart, even if nothing's in your shopping cart, which I don't really like. And some little things like that. There's some animations, like the slide out animation for the sidebar, I think is cute the first time, and then by the fifth time you're like, I just want to get to this thing. So I think stuff there. For me personally, I do my Cinema Gadfly blog, and I have been depending on certain image sizes for the covers for the films that they aspect ratio wise resize to the size I use for my site, and the new ones don't. So I have to decide if I'm going to kind of shoehorn or if I'm going to actually, for the first time since I launched the site, what, like 5 years ago, consider doing a redesign of my site. And at the moment I'm leaning sort of towards redesign because the Criterion site is sort of inspiring me to do something maybe a little more similar to it in terms of a little bit bolder, a little bit wider, a little bit different layout, and using the really nice giant covers that they have now. And also, as a random tidbit, one thing that was really annoying on the old site, if you were relying on Criterion's covers, is that when a new Blu-ray would come out for something like, say, Beauty and the Beast, but they hadn't sold out of the DVDs yet, they would have both covers, the DVD and the Blu-ray run, but the Blu-ray run had that awful Blu-ray sticker on it. And so I would have to keep using the old awful DVD one because I was not willing to put that Blu-ray sticker on my site. Anyway, this is all super inside baseball, but the new site's really nice in a lot of ways. It'll take some getting used to. There are some kinks to work out. That's my takeaway.
Robert, you got a soundbite for us on the new website?
I like it, period.
Good enough.
Unfortunately don't know, have all of the inside baseball insight that Arik has. I will simply say I think it looks fantastic on mobile.
It really does. They did a great job.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I miss, it doesn't seem quite, I mean, you can read about the films and you can apparently find the essays and stuff. It seems a little harder to just sort of study up on a film in the same way. Maybe it's because the visuals do kind of overtake the links to the essays and all that. And you also cannot scroll from one spine number to another at the bottom of the page like you could through the old site. So I did kind of enjoy sort of running through the sequence, if you will. So I hope that there's some interesting ways to start sorting and you know, creating our own lists and categorizing and whatnot. So when the My Criterion features come back online, I think that's going to be kind of my make or break. I do enjoy the look of it. The first week there where you open up the site and there's Johnny Depp's pimply face kind of staring up at you, it's like, okay, I've seen enough of that. Can we kind of go ahead and switch? So now we've got the kind of kaleidoscopic multi-image from Moonrise, which I think I'll be reviewing pretty soon for Criterion Cast. I got a review copy. Really enjoyed that, kind of gathering my thoughts on it. So, yeah, I'm very eager to see where the website goes, and that's probably about enough of that.
as a last note, absolutely. One other really nice thing that they did is that you can now, from any films page, see if it's on Filmstruck or not.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's nice. The Filmstruck integration is definitely a good boost, and ultimately, it would be nice if some of the non-disc releases from Filmstruck on the Criterion Channel would have a page on the site and really continue to grow that. I know that's a lot of work because there are a lot of non-Criterion disc titles on Filmstruck.
Well, even the ones which, that are... One. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even the ones like this one.
Yeah, so yeah, let's talk about it. We are talking about The Scandalous Adventures of Buraikan, or... pretty much as it's known in Japanese, just Buraikan. And before you draw any conclusions, let's just tell you first and foremost, there is no character named Buraikan in this movie, which was a bit of a puzzler to me.
Want my money back.
Yeah, really. Kind of freezing us up right from out the gate there. But this is a film by Masahiro Shinoda. He is kind of one of those B-tier Japanese New Wave directors who's done a lot of interesting stuff. Maybe his most famous film, he did Pale Flower. I think he did Kuroneko. Those are probably the two primary Criterion Blu-rays that he's best known for. Let me make sure. Am I correct on Kuroneko, or am I getting him confused with a different director?
I don't think he did Kuroneko.
Cinematographer of this film did Kuroneko, I believe. Okay. You're thinking of Double Suicide, perhaps?
Well, Double Suicide,
Yeah, he also did the original version of Silence, which Martin Scorsese remade 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seemed like there was one other Blu-ray release. He did Samurai Spy, which is in that,
The Samurai box set
there.
Yeah.
Kind of four random mid-60s samurai films. So you take that lineup of titles together, and you get a guy who's made some interesting stuff, but it doesn't feel quite like a cohesive body of work that you might get with a Suzuki or a Kobayashi or, some of the bigger names of Japanese cinema. We've just rattled off a few Shinoda titles. How much exposure have you guys had to any of those other films that he's made?
I've seen Double Suicide, and I've seen clips from the original Silence, and that's it.
Okay.
I own all of his films, but this was the first one I'd watched.
Okay, so we are kind of coming at it from a little bit of a novice point of view here. Trevor and I talked about Double Suicide in season one of this podcast. This is Shinoda's follow-up to Double Suicide. So, Robert, what was your take on that film? How did you dig that one?
I adored Double Suicide. Mm-hmm. It's visually engaging, it's emotionally and mentally stimulating, and I just never seen a movie like it before. It's one of those films that sort of exists unto itself in a very, very interesting, puppety way. And even though it's been several years since I've seen it, the images still linger with me, and the moments of real tragedy do as well. So I liked it quite a bit.
Yeah, I did too. I think that was interesting, some would call it his masterpiece. It was done through the Art Theater Guild, ATG, which was kind of a high concept art house Japanese indie studio of the late 60s into the early 70s. The Yoshida box set put out by Arrow a couple years ago is kind of a nice showcase for that particular director. And so there's kind of an archness and a kind of a cutting edge avant-garde feel, and Double Suicide to me felt like it kind of played along that line as well. Buraikan is a different matter. This is a interesting kind of a period piece with some sexiness, with some humor. It could be, and I will just start off by saying it was to me initially kind of a befuddling film. I mean, even from the opening credits, I'm hearing this kind of cool jazzy soundtrack, and I really haven't read up much on it, and so I'm thinking some kind of a spy caper, some kind of a smart alecky kind of leading man type. It kind of went off in some different directions, and it took me a second viewing to really sit down, focus up, and unlike most podcasts, I don't always take notes. In fact, I rarely do. I just kind of go with it. This one here, I had to write some things down to keep track of what was going on. So who'd like to kind of launch off, give us maybe a first take, a summary? I'll throw it out there.
A summary of the film.
I can try.
Sure, give it a shot, Robert.
So, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it properly, but Mizuno Tadanuki, I think his name is. He's a lord, and he has basically taken away any moral pleasure of this section of Japan at all. You can't read books, you can't have theater, you can't even wear clothes that have gold, string in them. And it's sort of about the rebellion of the lower classes against the upper classes, despite the fact that it does not seem like anything is going to change, and it's basically like punching water. There are a couple vignettes, I guess one would call them, of smaller characters within this town that's the center of the story, one of whom is a guy who aspires to be an actor who is in love with a sex worker, and who continually attempts to murder his mother so that he can get her inheritance and marry the sex worker. The murdering of the mother, however, never sticks. Another subplot...
And it's done for comical effect.
Done for comical effect, which could not be more totally different than the story of a poor man who left the town, his wife hanged himself, his daughter... his son disappeared without any sort of trace, and he tries to track down the son. He ends up murdering a child, and he slowly goes crazy. So those seem to be the two main vignettes. There's other characters that bounce about, including a guy with a mole who's trying to assassinate the lord, but that seems to be the main thrust of the film itself.
I think it's a pretty fair rundown of the events. Well, maybe we'll get into sorting out what it all means. But Arik, how do you want to fill in the gaps there, or kind of give us your impressions?
Sure. First of all, worth noting that Mizuno Tadakuni, the lord that Robert mentioned at the beginning, was a real person. And this whole film takes place during something called the Tenpo reforms. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry. Which, as he said, was sort of a way to try to bring back the economic successes of the past by returning to earlier notions of morality. Didn't go super well. Spoiler. For me, I also, when the movie started, with the jazzy, well, actually, I heard the jazzy soundtrack at the beginning. I was like, "Ooh, this is gonna be cool," you know. And
me
I'm
too.
And I'm a huge fan of Tatsuya Nakadai, who probably most famous. Well, he's been in a lot. He's in a lot of stuff that's in Criterion, but for me, he's most famous as being in both Seven Samurai and The Sword of Doom. Mm-hmm. But he's also in, tons of movies.
His Seven Samurai bit is just kind of a walk across the screen, so Harakiri might be a better, kind of showcase for Nakadai's, especially his serious side.
I think it's just because I saw the Sword of Doom before I saw Seven Samurai.
Sure.
That when he walked across the street in Seven Samurai, I was like, oh my god, it's the dude, right?
Yeah.
Sword of Doom.
He was a complete unknown at that time.
Oh,
but
totally.
He definitely is one of the all-timers of Japanese cinema. And again, to be such a stone-cold badass in Sword of Doom and Harakiri, just such a gritty, intense
Human Condition.
Role. And Human Condition, my goodness, like 9 hours of just gritty gut punches one after the other. This here, he's kind of a bit of a screwball. And
he's like
it's
a clown,
really fun
yeah.
to see him kind of cutting loose like that.
Absolutely. So I was already on, because he's kind of the first person or one of the first people you see in the film. And I was like, okay, I'm kind of getting set up for this to be. But then I'm like, oh, okay, it's also a period piece. That's interesting. Didn't necessarily see that coming. And like you said, the film is very complicated and definitely, I think, probably benefits from a pretty deep understanding of the specifics of the time period and the social situations that are being referred to. I think there's a lot of parody of social conventions and commentary on modern Japanese society in 1970 using this past time period as an example, all these kind of things. And I think that can be hard to figure out if you don't have the background. I found myself the first time I saw it sometimes pausing it and reading up on a particular time period or a particular person. Even with that said, I really, really enjoyed the film. And I think that even having no real strong understanding of what the heck is going on, there's a lot to recommend here. It's an extremely fun film, and it's interesting, and there's different, like Robert said, there's different sort of emotional vibes, right, from the sort of very silly subplots to the deadly serious plots and kind of everything in between. There's some weird stuff with masks and some weird things around death and demons and all. There's just a lot going on, and it's kind of, it reminded me a little bit in a weird kind of way of another director from a similar time frame, but sort of like the Robert Altman vibe of say like Nashville or or almost what's that movie called, the really, really weird one he did after MASH, really weird one with Bud
Two
Cort.
Women?
Oh. No, the one with Bud Cort, it's hard to find. I have it. Brewster McCloud. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have not, no.
It is one of the single weirdest films that I have ever seen. And it was what he made literally right after MASH with the sort of MASH permissions. Anyway, you should check it out sometime. But this has kind of an ensemble feel in that kind of way, where there's a lot of stories that kind of intersect in ways that you don't necessarily see coming at the beginning. There's some kind of silly stuff. There's some serious stuff. And I don't know. I really, really enjoyed it. And I found myself wishing that this was a mainline release. First of all, because I think it's worthy, but also because then there would be some context.
Yeah, it would definitely be great to get some supplemental material on this. Robert, you and I John Lobinger talked about the Yojimbo meets Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. God, that one screwed up there. So Zatoichi meets Yojimbo. And we definitely, puzzled and strained our brain a bit over all the plot machinations in that one. And I know that you were a little less than impressed, like we might say. But how did all the convoluted nature of the narrative fit with you this time?
See, I thought that this was better because the point of Zatoichi meets Yojimbo was, I think it was supposed to make sense, and it didn't make sense. Whereas here, I sort of accepted it on a minute-to-minute basis. Everything was going to be different. I think Ark was genius with his comparison to Altman's Nashville, where one moment it's completely tragic, the next moment, you're engaged romantically, the next moment you're laughing. That's sort of how if you take this movie scene by scene and just sort of take each scene as an island unto itself, then it's much easier to swallow and enjoy. And I did enjoy it very much. I agree with Ark. I wish that it was a mainline release because I want that booklet so I can understand more of what was going on. Unlike him, I did not pause it. I just went on all the way through, and I ultimately watched the film 3 times as a result. And there are just some lovely visual moments. There are some very, very interesting character moments that seem insane out of context, but also are incredibly beautiful and very, very endearing. Mm-hmm. So I very much enjoyed the film as well. What did you think, David?
Well, to me, the first time through, I've watched it through twice now, including once just today, just to kind of get refreshed for the episode here. The first time through, you're right, it was all these vignettes and all these really amusing, turnabouts and scenarios and moments, but trying to cohesively say, here's what the story is about, here's the kind of overall thrust of the film. I definitely knew after the first time through, that was entertaining. That was pretty imaginative, and I'm sure there's probably a lot more coherence to it than I picked up. But I did have to do a little bit of reading up, you know, hit my Wikipedia, learned about the tempo reforms and this period. This is kind of like the early to mid 1800s, 1820s, 1830s era, a kind of an austerity movement, a decision by the powers that be to kind of buckle down, get back to basics, you know, shoulder to the wheel, nose to the grindstone, all that kind of Western cliches. This is the Japanese version of that, you know, just kind of, you know, get serious, kind of, you know, put the distractions away, get productive, and kind of a puritanical movement here. We can look back at chapters in our own history, I suppose, here in the U.S. or in Europe or wherever, and say, yeah, you know, the human societies go through these kind of ups and downs, and this is kind of one of those kind of, you know, more austere moments in the Japanese saga. So you know, and I'm sure within the context of its cultural situation when the film first came out, people knew those reference points. You sort of see where the film is going. I guess at the end, I kind of got this hippies versus the cops thing going on, you know, with the actors and the outcasts kind of, you know, stirring up in revolt against the lords and the powers, with a bit of a kind of a pessimistic, you know, nothing's really going to change message coming through at the end of it all. And certainly that, as Arik said, connects with Japanese currents in society, but you could say the whole, you know, the whole world, it was going through this youth versus tradition revolt in the late 60s, early 70s. And of course, I've talked about those themes ad nauseum. I'm sure I'm not done, but this is just kind of another portrayal of that, you know. I also had to kind of remark at the parallels between the beginning of this film and the previous film I podcasted about, Multiple Maniacs by John Waters. Both of the films start with kind of a carny barker out there kind of luring people in to see this tawdry spectacle and kind of play into the cheap seats there, people who want to see something kind of depraved and outrageous to get their kicks. And so I
think it's safe to say that this is the first time in history that anyone has compared these two things, David. So congratulations.
It's probably true.
They were released within days of each other in 1970, in April 1970. So there was something.
So there you go.
I guess we could say. but yeah, it definitely goes in a much different direction than Multiple Maniacs. So I guess the parallels end pretty quickly. But you know, but they both do kind of have a commentary about straight society versus the you know, the artistic/lunatic fringe, and so that maybe there is a little bit more of a common theme going on. But yeah, I definitely enjoy this. This is a movie that definitely requires a little bit of homework, unless you're already naturally a student of Japanese history, or for whatever reason this just kind of kicks in and your brain kind of assimilates all that right off the bat. You're going to have to dig a little bit deeper, and I imagine that may be one of the reasons that Criterion has not yet chosen to release it as a standalone title. Shinoda is still a little bit more of a, you know, kind of a, you know, second level of director, and, you know, despite Nakadai's, I think, excellent performance, it doesn't necessarily seem like it may pack the punch of a more kind of mainstream, you know, Japanese title from this era. Even like the Lady Snowbloods have kind of that kind of, you know, action chick thing going for them in a way that this one doesn't quite you know, offer.
They should market it by saying it's 14 movies for the price of one, and at least 9 of them are good.
Yeah.
I want to say, by the way, in addition to Tatsuya Nakadai, who was incredible, I thought Shima Iwashita, who was Shinoda's wife, or maybe is, I think Shinoda's dead, but maybe he's not actually. Anyway, she was brilliant as Nakadai's girlfriend slash love interest of the sort of semi, I guess, evil, I'm not sure what he was, semi-lord, I don't know.
Well, Mizuno you're talking about?
No, the smaller dude, the dude who tried to have Nakadai killed.
Oh yeah, Morataya was his. These are my notes here. So I've memorized all that. Yeah, so yeah, that's the thing. You've got this really complex set of characters, but Morataya is this kind of, I guess he's kind of a businessman. He's kind of a, you know, he's a guy with a little bit of clout. He's, I think temperamentally the kind of guy who would say, "Yeah, Mizuno, we gotta, you know, settle those ruffians down. We gotta get them, more productive and less indulgent." But of course, he's got his own little thing going on the side, and he expects Michitose, the geisha woman, the sex worker, to be kind of his exclusive customer, or he's her exclusive customer, and he even wants maybe a little bit of her emotional investment in him, and of course she's not really buying that. And so he comes to see Naojiro as a rival, and of course Naojiro has that pretty brilliant scene of Naojiro kind of making the career transition from fortune teller to aspiring actor. And he has this "I see death's shadow in your face" little routine that he goes, and he gets him in Japanese culture this very embarrassing, humiliating stance where you're down on all fours with your butt up in the air.
Yeah, inspiring acting. Inspiring actor of real life acting, right? Like of
yeah. Towards the end there, he becomes an actor in a real life pageant, if you will.
Yeah.
So yeah, all these little subplots and the way they interconnect, again, the second viewing definitely opens up that territory quite a bit, if you didn't catch it the first time around.
What surprises me so much about his character trying to be a fortune teller is that his line of bullshit works. Like, Arik, if I came up to you and just said, "I see the shadow of death across your face," chances are you would just punch me, correct? Or at least run away.
Well, I'm not really much of a puncher, but I don't know if I would do exactly what you said.
He'd find the other side of the sidewalk, at least.
Yeah.
Yes. Whereas everyone in this film seemingly falls for it immediately and has no problem swallowing it. So good for him for pulling that off, right?
Well, you know how to tap into the zeitgeist. What's the prevailing superstition? Let's go ahead and play off that.
I do want to mention, though, one of the only, in a movie that is fairly complicated, confusing, and not necessarily easy to follow, the one logical jump that I didn't actually find any sort of hint at, and maybe I need to watch it yet again, which I will anyway because it's awesome. But he runs into Michitose in the market, and he tries his "you're gonna die" or you're gonna fall in love with me line, and she just says no, not at all. And then the next time we see them together, they're in love. Right?
Do you think he went to her as a paying customer and kind of won her over that one?
Well, I would assume, but we don't know, right?
Right. Yeah, because you're right. They're pretty much like a couple. Like, in fact, she's really servicing him, and it's not a perfunctory. I mean, there's nothing really sexually explicit. There's a few bare breasts, and even Nakadai gets down to his little thongy thing there, which is pretty gutsy there. Yeah, when the mother gets up out of her tub there.
Quite surprised by that one, I have to say. I was like, oh, okay.
Exactly. But yeah, you're right. There's a spark of a relationship that kind of erupts a little bit off camera. There's a little bit of an ellipsis there. But pretty much from the time she blows him off to the next time you see him together, they're pretty much a thing now.
They're totally a thing, yeah.
Right. So you've got that, you've got the, and then, yeah, Kochiyama, the guy with the mole, I guess he's probably the other big through line here.
I love that we're just calling him the guy with the mole.
Kind of is.
I mean, he's referred to by name on several occasions, but that's kind of the easiest way to tell him apart. He's interesting because he's a faithful attendant to Lord Mizuno. I mean, he is right there on the inner circle of the, you know, the austere puritanical reformer, Mr. Sourpuss there, who's spoiling everybody's fun, but at the same time, he is plotting anarchy and chaos and subterfuge. So it's a very fascinating portrait of a character who's, and he's got the physique of kind of a no-nonsense action man. You know, he's built, he's probably good 5-6 inches taller than a lot of the other cast. And so you get a sense of intrigue going on there as well, because he's the one who's taking the direct orders from the boss, who's taken down all the fun and pleasurable things of life, but he is also very much involved in an undoing all of that. And he's got one of these kind of more cynical takes on things about just, you know, he's just here to stir up trouble, basically, and laying low until the time is right to strike.
And he picked the wrong time.
Well, in the end, maybe not. I mean, I think he did disrupt things, and he knew that it would cost him when he was when it was time to play his cards. Again, I don't think he's aspiring to be a leader of a revolution, revolutionary movement where he takes over as the big boss. He's more just a disruptor, just an agent of chaos.
Yeah, I would say he waited a little bit long to do what he was going to do in Mizuno's room, because by the time he could have accomplished his ultimate goal had he just moved a little quicker. Mm-hmm. But, mm-hmm. By the way, just as a through line between this and Kuroneko, the lady who played the damsel in distress that they were rescuing,
mm-hmm.
she's in Kuroneko.
Okay, wow, that's great memory. Had you like followed that, or
she just looked really familiar, so I looked it up. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
I think he's a great character too, because you just aren't really sure what his deal is, right? Like, why is he doing what he's doing? There's a lot
mm-hmm.
of like reveals over time in the film.
How about the other guy, the pale faced? I guess he's a little bit of a kind of a whitish pancake.
Oh, Kaneko.
Kaneko, yeah, he's just the stone cold killer there. He whether you're in power or out of power, he's another just, you know, he's just a guy who's out to kill, name the target, you know, give me my money, and I'll do the deed. So you get a sense that despite the hearkening back to traditional morality and the stout values of olden times, there's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of backstabbing, a lot of betrayal and mistrust that permeate this particular era of Japanese society. And I don't know, do you guys see a kind of a commentary either on times past or present in all of that? To me, it just feels like those politicians who like to get up on that platform are really some of the dirtiest dealers you've ever seen.
Before we jump into that, do you know that guy who played Kaneko was in Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo?
I didn't pick up on that. I didn't really study the cast members of this other than Nakadai, I suppose. Yeah.
He was,
and I've done my best to forget that movie existed.
He was Boss Masagoro in Zatoichi Meets Yojimbo, just because you guys mentioned it earlier.
Yeah, well, he definitely has that stone face, you know, aspect to him.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to derail. I just, it was so funny that you mentioned, because
it's great.
Mentioned before. You were saying, Robert?
Oh, I was going to say, always find throughout history that in order to enforce the quote-unquote morality that they find so important, they always have to do things that are amoral. And this is no exception, correct? They do things that are completely amoral by arresting people who have done nothing wrong, robbing people of their lifestyles, etc., etc., which are, at least to me, far more of a sin than just doing the sex work or, you know, being in a theater or apparently wearing gold thread. And in doing so, they sort of become the ultimate villains. And I think that that's something that has been revisited throughout history. Mm-hmm. Whenever we come into this sort of buttoned-up era, something like that ultimately happens.
Yeah, I would... So for me, I thought it was really fascinating at the end, where that Mizuno guy was like, there are no fireworks, I banned them, even though the dude had opened the door to show the
fire.
You
see him right there.
They're exactly. Just like literally right there, and he won't even turn to look because he's very focused. The historical Mizuno, it didn't work out super great for him. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's probably a commentary on sort of what was going on. I wish I knew more about sort of the situation in 1970 Japan to understand better what the commentary was on the society of the time. Like, how did Shinoda feel? And that's where we wish this had some more supplementary material. But like, what is the through line between 1970 Japan and this part of Japan, this time in Japan? But yeah, I definitely think that the commentary on all of the different sort of respectable people, and even the filial relationship between the son and his mother, you know, where he twice throws her in the water or whatever. But the guy, the attendant, he goes to rescue this daughter, which is ostensibly a good thing, but he only does it for a bunch of money. Like, so you know, everyone's kind of got their angle, I guess.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The last phase of the film, you basically kind of have an hour of setup where it looks like, I guess Morataya's contract on Nojiro is kind of the driving force. He gets Kaneko in there to kind of, you know, take out his nemesis, and then yeah, so you see all those and the other guy, Kochiyama. So all four of them come together at a bathhouse, and that's when you think, well, is this going to be the big showdown? And it's like, yeah. No, they actually join forces. And so just as you're thinking, okay, here we go, this is the big, you know, at least one pivotal battle. Well, that all gets kind of just set aside in a moment because there's now this other big fish to fry, and so yeah, you've basically. Robert said, "What, 9 movies or 14 movies, and 9 of them are good." Yeah, this is definitely kind of a culmination point, and then we go off in a whole bunch of new directions for the last 45 minutes or so of the film. So, yeah, you're right. All these vignettes, and as I said in the Zatoichi versus or meets Yojimbo, I think there was a sort of an appreciation within the Japanese. Film fandom of really complicated kooky plots, and I think this plays into that as well, where the more intricate you can interweave the pieces, there's people who are just going to kind of dig that sort of thing. So that's not exactly what you get from Hollywood movies in modern times or even throughout the decades, where things are made pretty crystal clear and kind of spoon-fed to the audience. So you have to definitely have to adjust your sensibilities a little bit here. But I do enjoy that last section there where they kind of conspire to put this little pageant on, if you will, in order to rescue this woman who's been held captive. And again, so now you've got another lord, Matsue, who's kind of another corrupted household. I don't know, Arik, did you come across the House of Matsue at all in any of your reading up on this? I don't know if that's another historical reference point or if this is just kind of a fictional character, but it is kind of interesting how we transition from Mizuno to Matsue as kind of the focal point of institutional evil.
Yeah, I didn't find anything out about him as a real person, but yeah, definitely a very different vibe in his household. I know that he was a daimyo, which ultimately the various daimyos were what brought Mizuno down. That he was very, very unpopular with them because of the failures of the reforms. And then Edo Castle burned down. And that was the kind of the final straw. And he was fired from the government and exiled. Mizuno, I mean. But no, I didn't find anything out about that guy specifically as a real person. And I would wonder if he was real or not. But yeah, he was definitely he's not a nice guy.
No, and I mean he's kind of hedonistic and maybe even a little bit sadistic. He's got a young woman, really a girl who's been resisting his advances. She's apparently the most beautiful of his I don't know what you would call his concubines, and he can't have her. So if she won't yield, then he must kill her. And so there's a little bit of a melodrama, really. I mean, it becomes very theatrical, and this is again. Where theatricality for as a profession has been outlawed, so now theatricality spills over into real life because that's the only place you can practice.
That's
those
an interesting
arts.
Point. That's a yeah, great point. Yeah.
And so it really does, doesn't it? Didn't it feel to you like those whole scenes were just kind of this almost operatic? You know, to kind of borrow some of William Remmer's terminology there. There was this kind of operatic thing. You know, the lord commanding the young woman and the gallant. Member of his retinue standing between the young woman whose life is at risk and the lord who demands her sacrifice, and he's doing it for the House of Matsue. So there is this kind of, overblown element there, and then of course it all gets disrupted by this kind of farcical visit by a supposed monk who's there to deliver a message on a secret mission.
The series of archetypes, if you will.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
And I love the way that the screenplay painted around the edges in those sequences, like when all of a sudden the one woman comes up and she's like, "No, she's a whore. Don't you understand? I saw them sleeping together." And then it cuts
right,
to the other
one. Because there's all, like, these false testimonies and additional layers of intrigue all piling up on you.
Yeah, the two women who were just whispering in the background, and she was like, "Well, she wouldn't know either way, but I suspect the blah, 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 blah." And I'm like, ooh, this is exciting. It just made it feel like, even though, as you said, it was very, very theatrical, it grounded it in a weird way and made it seem like, oh, stuff has happened in this location beforehand, stuff is going to happen after we leave this castle as well. And it made it seem a little bit more... realistic is the wrong word, because you are correct that it is theatrical, but it at least tethered you enough to not think that it was hugely melodramatic simply for the point of melodrama.
And of course it turns into a big, big old battle showdown there. You know, there's the kind of the jig is up type of thing, the reveal where he's an imposter and all of that back and forth as well.
That had that awesome, like, "What, you can't do anything to me" moment, where it's just like, I walked to this point. Are you going to still try to do something here?
Right, because once I step off of your porch, I'm into the Shogun's property, and if you touch me, you'll be accountable to him. And it's like, foiled again.
Exactly. You know? So good.
We can't do that. So the gang makes its getaway, and of course, you've got all... Not just the guy with the mole doing his thing, but you've had everybody else kind of playing a part and helping to rescue the young girl. So there's that good deed done, and then of course we got the fireworks. The
even with the good deed done, it's so this movie is so perfect. It's like that they go to let her out, and the Nakadai is just like, "So do you want to sleep with me before you go?" While his girlfriend or wife or whatever is like being led away by his friends.
Right.
Like, just hey,
gotta,
you know,
give one last roll of the dice there. Exactly. You never know what you might turn up, right? And then the fireworks. I guess the fireworks is kind of the big symbolic FU, middle finger to the man. We're gonna stick it to the establishment, up against the wall, right? We're gonna blow off some fireworks and show you what's up, right? Well, and then, of course, as you've already said, Mizuno was just very stoic in his denial. It doesn't faze him at all. You know, go ahead, blow off all your fireworks. I'm not going to acknowledge it. That's just the Shogun's militia practicing their military tactics. You know, some target practice.
Well, and ultimately, really, nothing happens, right? Because he wins. Everyone gets arrested.
Well, that's basically his final statement. He says, "Did you think a revolt could overthrow power? Only those holding power change." In other words, power will do what it's going to do. Yeah, you can bring in the revolution, you can get the uprising and the revolt of the peasants, but once those peasants become the powerful, they will do what the powerful people do. And so there is a kind of nothing new under the sun element to all of this, as far as the social upheaval, the desire to overthrow the structures and chalk one up for liberty and freedom of expression. I mean, I think there's always going to be an ebb and flow to all of that, and I think you can historically make the case that there are some governments that are more righteous and equitable than others. I think it would be foolish to say, well, they're all like that, but from the point of view of those who are entrenched in power, they kind of have that unflappable cynicism, if you will, that, give us your best shot. You know, once you sit in my place, you will do the same kind of manipulative, soul-crushing, corrupt deeds that I find necessary to maintain my own grip on worldly power. So
yeah, the name on the door changes, but nothing else changes.
Exactly. Yeah. And you would understand it differently if you were in my position. So
totally.
There is a little sobering food for thought for all of us would-be revolutionaries out there.
And of course, that's underlined in a more humorous way by the fact that the guy keeps trying to murder his mother to get his inheritance, and she just refuses to die, no matter what. Right, at the end, they make a joke out of it with, "Well, you're going to try and overthrow me again, but don't throw me in the river. I don't want to be cold this time."
He'll find another way, but basically, yeah, we got to get Mama out of the way so that we can sleep.
We can be a couple, because she's sleeping between the two of them.
So again, the political winds will blow where they will, but there's still the fundamental matters of getting with your lover and getting hold of that money. Okay. Well, anyways, hey, this is a definitely a we're kind of into some more obscure territory. This is a bit of a discovery, one that may not naturally stumble across listeners' paths, but I think it's one worth recommending. And as I, again, the caveat there is that you got to do a little bit of research to make sense of it, and maybe give it a second spin through before you feel like you've gotten everything that the film has to offer.
Well, I have to say this is one of those.
But even though you have to watch it two times, I think it bears noting the fact that the first time you watch it, it's not going to be like taking your medicine.
No, no.
You are going to enjoy it immensely the first time, and enjoy it even more the second time when you're like, oh, so that's who that is.
Exactly. Yeah, it's definitely entertaining, well-constructed. Arik, I think you had a comment, too.
Yeah, I just want to say that your older podcast did a great job of introducing folks, including myself, to the Eclipse series, which was like one level of sort of lesser watched films, less discussed films in the collection. And I'm so happy that you're doing this, because with these streaming only titles or former Laserdisc titles or whatever titles that are not as talked about, not as visible, because I would not have probably watched this film under any real other circumstances unless I someday got into a, you know, Shinoda kick. And I just really enjoyed the film, so I'm just really glad I saw it. So I just want to say to kind of everyone out there, like, this is awesome. Like, this is awesome,
definitely.
What David's doing here.
Well, and I really do appreciate you guys taking the time to watch it with me and have this conversation. I think a Shinoda Eclipse, that would be outstanding.
Agreed.
You're right. I mean, it's probably, you know, this is a standalone Blu-ray. I think it has merit for it, whether there's enough supplemental features or box office clout or whatever you want to call it. But you put three or four or five of these things into a little box, I think you got yourself something there. So here's hoping. Yeah, and then Silence, of course, adaptation of a novel about Christianity in Japan in kind of the 1600s or whenever that was, remade, you know, a couple years ago by Martin Scorsese. That'll be coming up as another Shinoda film in my queue here, so we'll probably dig into that one down the road. He did some exceptional, important work, and definitely deserves a little bit more of the spotlight than he seems to be getting, so...
And I'm going to echo Arik here and say, the only reason I watched this movie is because I enjoyed myself in our conversations the first three times we did this.
Oh,
so much.
Yeah,
and so
for sure.
When you said, no, pick some more, I literally, David, closed my eyes, opened the Excel spreadsheet, pointed, and this movie came up.
That's great. Yeah, love it. Yeah, well... Excellent. Well, thank you so much, guys. I really appreciated the conversation, as I always do. But this is definitely one I would not have wanted to do a solo podcast. I'm glad you enjoyed it. We'll definitely see what the roll of the dice turns up the next time. Yeah, I guess we have to there was that little Zatoichi gambling thing going on there too. That's just another little connection point there. So, all right, guys. Well, I think we hit lucky sevens on this one. So we'll be talking to you all real soon. Thanks a lot.